from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans is with us to talk about an effort by congressional Republicans to make the right to carry concealed guns the law of the land from Texas to Boston.
I just don't see the mentality that more guns is going to make our community safer. We see in the inner city what more guns do, and it's creating too many young lives being lost in our city.
Also today, Pat Purcell on the uncertain future of the Boston Herald and his difficult decision to declare bankruptcy and sell the paper.
This will be my 34th anniversary as publisher of the Boston Herald come January. So it's a very emotional day.
And local dance legend Tony Williams joins us to talk about blending Tchaikovsky and Duke Ellington in the Urban Nutcracker. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're going to begin today with Boston Police Commissioner William Evans. He's live in our studio, and there's a lot to talk about, from a recent gun buyback program in Boston to last week's five-year anniversary of the Sandy Hook school massacre to efforts by Republicans in Congress to push a concealed carry reciprocity bill. We'll talk about what that is and why people like Bill Evans say it would undermine the state's gun laws. And Commissioner Evans, welcome back to Radio Boston. It's always good to have you.
Thank you, Anthony. Nice to be here.
And we want to invite our listeners into this conversation. Do you have questions for Police Commissioner Bill Evans? He's happy to take them. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Commissioner, let's start with this gun buyback program, which happened last week through the weekend. What happened? How did it work out?
Well, we had different communities. We had Worcester and other communities around New England who were all part of Mayor Walsh's regional gun summit. You know, we've had several meetings. So we did a gun buyback the other day in different states and in different cities. And I think at the end of the day, we had close to 1,000 guns off the street in New England, and in Boston we had 64 taken off. Mm-hmm. and some of them were rifles, some of them semi-automatic. So you know, from 10 to 4, that's pretty good production, you know. And I always say, you know, it's 64 less guns out in the street or in people's homes where young kids can get their hands on them. You know, people, and we know you know, a lot of suicides with guns just left lying around. So
is that a good number, though? I mean, you're going to hear some people sort of push back and say, well, you know, gun buybacks, people are just going to sort of give you guns that they don't really care about, or the lesser guns. Right. How do we know that it's making a difference?
Well, I can tell you, you know, one gun in the hands of a young child can end up in tragedy. And when Mayor Walsh and myself were newly created in our positions, I always remember going to a call on Morton Street when a 14-year-old playing with a gun in the house, left unattended, shot his 9-year-old brother. So when I look at instances like that, if that gun wasn't there, and you know, maybe that tragedy wouldn't happen. And that's why we have a lot of programs in the city to try to prevent that. You know, we sent a letter to all the registered gun owners in the city asking them, if they don't want their gun, we'll buy it off you. If you're going to keep it, we'll give you a gun lock. And the requirement, if you're going to sell it, you got to go online and record that. Because one of the biggest issue with us is always tracing the true owner of a gun. So we're doing a lot of things to try to prevent tragedies like that one we've seen on Morton Street.
We are talking to Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Sarah, who's calling from Jamaica Plain with a question. Hey, Sarah, you're on the air with the commissioner.
Thank you. I was wondering how Congress could pass a law on what basis that would pertain to the states, since, as I understand it, it's just regulating commerce that that Congress can pass laws that affect states.
So, Sarah, you're calling about the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act, right?
Correct.
Okay. So, Commissioner, let's just give the listeners a little bit of background. So the House passed this bill that it was essentially require states like Massachusetts, and correct me if I've got this wrong, to honor a gun permit, recognize a gun permit from any other state.
Right,
so correct. We have strict laws in this state, a state like, I don't know, Texas or South Carolina, not so strict. Massachusetts would have to recognize that. It passed the House. It's going to the Senate. What's your feeling about this bill?
Well, it's real troubling for me. In fact, there's 12 states out there that you don't even need a permit to carry, and they don't even do background checks on you. So if that was the case, any of those 12 states, based on their regulations, could carry a gun into Massachusetts. You know, we make sure anyone who wants a gun in our city, they have to give, or in our state, have to give a valid reason why they want it. They have to pass a firearm safety training course, as well as live fire. You know, we have strict requirements that you need to have certain training requirements. You can't have domestic violence in your background, any issues. You can't have any type of violent felonies. In a lot of these states, you can be teenagers and actually possess guns. So the last thing we need in our state and across this country is loosening up the gun laws. Every day in our country, we probably lose close to 100 individuals due to gun violence in our state. You know, look at a state like Chicago. Close to 650 kids shot or adults shot this year, over almost 3,500 shot. It's like a war zone. So the last thing we should be doing is making guns more readily available so people can cross state lines into states like ours who have tough gun laws, and we have the lowest amount of gun fatalities of any state, and that's because of our tough laws.
And just to be very clear what a law like this would do, so, I mean, let's just game out a situation. So you put a lot of effort, for example, into setting up security around the Boston Marathon, for example.
Right.
So this would allow somebody from one of those 12 states who's carrying a concealed gun to come right into that area. There's nothing you could do to stop them, right?
No, right up to the right up along the barrier line, and you know, any special event, whether we have a free speech rally down on the Common, which have been very contentious, and I thought our officers did a great job of keeping people apart, but any public event, walking through Copley Mall or through Quincy Market, the last thing we need is people to have guns or a fight at Quincy Market or any one of our bars. Like last night I was reading New York City, right in the middle of Times Square, a bar fight, and one guy shot another one, a 27-year-old dead. So, you know, unfortunately, people don't fight anymore with their hands, and if we have guns in everybody's hands, we're only going to have more tragedy.
Well, Commissioner, let me play you a little bit of tape. This is sort of a pushback to your argument. Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League here in Massachusetts, that's an NRA affiliate, says the law would protect Second Amendment rights of legal gun owners moving across state lines. Here's a bit of what he said.
They never committed a crime in their life, maybe never even had a traffic ticket in their life, but because they crossed the state border, they're suddenly a felon and their life is destroyed. And that's simply wrong. We can't do that in this country anymore.
And this is the argument that you hear again and again from the NRA, right? So, you know, why should we prevent law-abiding citizens from moving across state lines from one state to the other?
Because some states don't have practically any regulations to carry a gun. Now, it's like if that's the case, then we're only going to have more issues. I've said before, 12 states, you don't even need a background check.
Right.
You know, the NRA worked hard against the national database so we can check out people's records in across the country. So, you know, the NRA is always going to be pro-gun. You know, all our arguments. And I always say the NRA, most of their membership, I bet if you look, none of them live in the inner city like we do.
Mm-hmm.
None of them see the tragedies. None of them deal with the families on the streets. And, you know, you can live out in the suburbs and in some of the countryside. But I think if you live in the inner city and you see the tragedies, you see how many guns and the damage they do, I think you'd change your perspective like Mayor Walsh, like myself, in residents who have to live in these neighborhoods.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK if you'd like to ask a question of Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans, who's with us here at Radio Boston. Commissioner, last week, last Thursday, marked a really sad anniversary, the fifth anniversary of the terrible attack at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, where 20 children, six educators were killed. Speaking of this and the availability of guns, what were your thoughts on that anniversary?
Well, it's sad. It's sad that even after that, we haven't made any progress towards making ownership or possessing a handgun or the availability any harder. You know, we've had tragedy after tragedy, whether it's Las Vegas, Orlando. I read a statistic in the, I think, in the Globe last week. Since Sandy Hook, 6,500 children under the age of 17 have died as a result of gun violence. Over 30,000 wounded. So it's sad. Initially, for the first couple of days, everyone screams about, we got to get harder, we got to harder, but we haven't done anything. So I think Sandy Hook brings back how much damage handguns can do, any type of guns can do on young children, older children. It doesn't matter. Look at Las Vegas. I mean, the amount of people who have to go through the Christmas season with the memories of not having that loved one there. You know, this does substantial damage to our society. And so that's what Sandy Hook brings back, the tragedy, losing those young children, and the fact we haven't woken up to all tighten up on guns in this country.
It's true that since then there have been all number of mass shootings. I mean, the massacre at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. You mentioned Las Vegas, Sunderland Springs, Texas. The shootings of those congressmen playing baseball outside of Washington, D.C., on it goes. I want to just ask you about this, because what's your response to the argument against tougher gun control by people who, you know, use this line that the best defense against a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun? And in fact, we heard that last June when the gunmen opened fire on that congressional baseball practice. And someone from the NRA just made this argument to me the other day that some of those congressmen on the field and their staff members were actually licensed permit holders, but because they were in suburban Virginia, they weren't armed. And so they were helpless when this guy opened fire on them.
I mean, they can give one good example. I can give you a million bad examples. So, you know, if they want to use that one particular case, I can give you, you know, thousands of why we shouldn't have them, because these young kids in the inner city, unfortunately, get their hands, a lot of them on legal gun owners whose houses are broken into. I continually read these reports every day when we get the guns off the street, and they're taking from, you know, house breaks out of state, and they're making their way here into Massachusetts. So, you know, I know you're always going to give that argument, but I can give you a thousand times over why we shouldn't have them.
All right. Let's go to Tyler, who's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Tyler, you're on the air with Commissioner Evans.
Good morning. Good afternoon, Commissioner. I'm a Massachusetts National Guardsman. I recently moved to New Hampshire because Moore Healey made me a felon last year because I owned a rifle. But my question is, this proposed national reciprocity would just be making each state support Article 4 of the Constitution of the United States and recognizing other state licensures. If we really support, if we're really against national reciprocity, I swore an oath to the Constitution, you swore an oath to the Constitution, why don't we have our legislators propose a constitutional amendment rather than just continuing to ignore Article 4 of the U.S. Constitution?
Yeah. Well, again, thank you for your service. Obviously, first of all, I commend you. You know, I had three brothers who went off to Vietnam, so I commend you for your service. But you know what? Again, it's very much a safety issue in our city. I'm not against people from legally owning their guns, but they have to go through a stringent, requirement to get it. As we said, 12 states don't even do background checks on individuals. So you're going to have people who might have mental health issues getting guns. You might have people with domestic violence issues getting guns. You might have people with violent criminal backgrounds getting guns. So, you know, unfortunately, with a system like this, we won't be able to vet out those people. I'm sure you're well qualified, and I thank you for your service again. But unfortunately, you know, there's going to be people across this country who have no business getting a gun, getting it, if we don't hang tight and let the individual states monitor who's going to get their guns. Everyone in Boston who wants a license to carry concealed, I get to review. And if they don't have a legitimate reason for wanting to carry it, then we're not going to let them carry it.
We should point out, too, when folks talk about a constitutional right to carry a gun or to bear arms, that the Supreme Court, even the Supreme Court that has made favorable decisions about gun rights, has recognized the right of government to regulate, right? Regulate.
Yeah, that decision just came out.
Yeah, that decision just came out. So by placing regulations on who can carry a gun and under what circumstances isn't a denial of the constitutional right to bear arms.
Right.
Yeah. Let's go to Susan, who's calling from Newton. Susan, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just going to say something similar to what you said, because the argument from anti-gun control folks is that it's my Second Amendment right, my Second Amendment right. Well, it's doubtful in the first place, but even if you accept that, no right is absolute. You can't, you know, do anything you want just because it's the Second Amendment right. First Amendment right doesn't mean you can say anything at any time to anyone. So I think we need to speak back to that and say, yes, you may have that, but it's not absolute, as you just said.
Susan, thanks so much for the call. We really appreciate it. Commissioner Evans, I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned with all of these mass shootings, and we sort of set the date there at Sandy Hook 5 years ago, and yet the mass shootings continue and no action at the federal level. What would be the one most important piece of federal action? Now, if you could go down to Washington and say, hey, guys, you know, get it together, do this one thing, what would it be?
Well, honestly, I wish they all would establish the regulations that we have in our state, where everyone who wants a gun, there's a good background check. They're basically scrutinized to whether they're a capable person, mental health checks. And I think that's something we're always looking for, that national database and those, you know, the mental health check. Because, you know, again, I think Mayor and I've always said we're not against people legitimately having the right to bear arms, but we just want to make sure that there's a national standard for criminal background checks and there's mental health checks. And I think that's the number one priority that I wish the federal government would adopt. So we all have a tough sort of zero tolerance approach for making sure they get in the hands of rightful, proper people.
I want to move on to a couple of other issues while we have you. Let me ask you about this. On Friday, you signed a legal brief supporting the Deferred Action or Childhood Arrivals Policy. That's DACA, the program that allows some young immigrants who are brought to the country illegally as children to get work permits and get a reprieve from deportation. The Trump administration is trying to get rid of DACA, saying it's unconstitutional. Why do you think it's important?
Well, I think it's important because a lot of these young kids were brought over at young ages and, you know, from no fault of their own, they've established themselves here. They've been educated here. They've become part of the community. And, you know, they're shown that they're productive citizens. And just because of, a new policy, the fact that we will not renew their permit and ask them to leave, I think it's just not right. I mean, we work very hard with our immigrant population, especially in East Boston, where we have a lot of Central American kids. And, you know, to make them afraid of the police, and we've had built some strong relationships, I just don't see the rationale for doing it.
Have you seen evidence of that? Because that's what I wanted to ask you, the link, how it affects law enforcement efforts in the city.
Well, I can tell you, when we were last year, we had, we had MS 13, 18th Street gang issues. And, you know, it's very difficult to make inroads with immigrant populations because of the whole immigration issue. If they think we're the immigration police, then they're not going to report crimes, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, they're not going to be witnesses for us. They're not going to think that the police are their friend. And it erodes the whole trust between us. And no one works harder and stronger to build strong relationships within the Boston police. And, I know we hear the horror story occasionally of one illegal immigrant committing a crime, and that's highly put out in the papers. But there's so many good people who are so productive members of not only the city but across the country that I think it's unfair to have a blanket policy that everybody who's in this program should be kicked out.
As the Trump administration has taken a more hard line on immigration over the past year, have you seen changes in policing or had to oversee sort of changes in policing because of it?
We haven't changed our policy one bit. I always say we're not a sanctuary city like people sometimes like to think we are, because if someone commits a violent crime in our city, then we're going to cooperate with ICE, and we're going to turn them over. So, you know, I think we continue to build a lot of respect, a lot of trust with our community. I've always said we're not the immigration police. So I know the dialogue out there has been tough on the national level, but I haven't really seen it impact the job we're doing. And we're continually trying to reassure, especially a lot of our immigrant population, that we're here for them. And if they need anything, don't be afraid to contact us.
All right, Commissioner, we've got another caller. Tommy is calling from the North End in Boston. Tommy, you're on the air.
Thank you. Commissioner, I wanted to thank you because I really feel that you are showing some real leadership in, you know, our gun issues in Boston. However, I also think it is important to throw into these Second Amendment discussions, whatever happened to my right not to have to be shot? You know, I mean, really.
Right.
Tommy, I see where you're coming from there. What do you think, Commissioner?
Well, again, I don't, you know, see put more guns on the street, that we're all going to be safer. You know, again, I see these fights at night at clubs where, whether it's in Boston or anywhere, that normally would be with people's hands and fighting it out. The availability of more guns just leads to more violence. I don't care what you say. I mean, you can have a gun in the North End, but let's say you have a young child who puts their hand on it, or, you know, someone's drinking alcohol, or there's a domestic dispute, and a gun comes out. There's a lot more tragedies with guns hanging around than that one, again, that one instance where someone is the king in their castle and they kill someone. But more frequent than not, there's more tragedy because of a gun house in a house than the instance where you are. Now, the North End, knock on wood, that's probably one of the safest parts of the city. I don't think you need a gun or anyone for most of the city. You know, crime continues to come down in the city. This year, violent crime is down 6%. Yeah, we have pockets of violence in some parts of our community, but we're working hard to get the guns off there. But, you know, we're making tremendous strides to keep and make this city a safe city.
Tommy, thanks so much for that call. I want to ask you a little bit about the body cam pilot in Boston. Back in September, the Boston Police Department finished a year-long pilot program fitting some police officers with body cams. 100 officers and 8 command staff wore cameras. The preliminary review of that program is expected out by the end of the year. Can you give me any sort of early sense of how you think it went?
Well, I've said I thought the program went real well. Initially, it was 6 months, but, you know, we sort of had it set up so it was the colder months, which were our slower months. So we extended it for the whole year to get a good snapshot of the whole year. And we had 100 officers wear them, 100 not. And from all indications, you know, it was a successful program. So the officers didn't mind wearing them. I know we got a lot of good video footage that we were able to use in a court of law when we, for instance, had a gun arrest. We were able to document that. I've always said the program seems to be going great. The only issue is I think it's like $26 million over 3 years to get this program going. And so the cost benefit is something the mayor and I think the city council and all of us are going to have to realize. But honestly, we don't have a whole lot of use of force, knock on wood, in our city. Our officers do a great job, and we don't have a lot of complaints. But I think that's what we're going to measure. And I'm hoping by the first of the year, we'll have out those preliminary statistics. And I'm sure, you know, we have low numbers anyway. So, you know, that's what we'll measure, the complaints and the use of force.
Before this pilot program began, I remember talking to you about one of the concerns that you raised. I mean, you weren't necessarily saying I'm against it, but you raised the concerns that it might inhibit sort of some of the soft skills of police work.
Sure.
I mean, putting an arm around a kid who might be on the verge of committing, doing something bad and saying, hey, pal, let's talk this out. And obviously, filming that might inhibit those kinds of conversations. Do you still have those concerns?
I do, because I've looked at other communities that have done this study. You know, I looked at, Las Vegas recently completed a study. And basically what their study showed was, complaints went down a little bit and use of force went down.
Yeah.
But what went up was the amount of motor vehicle violations and their amount of arrests. So by taking away some of the discretion of the officers, I think the arrests went up by 6%. So that's troubling to me, that if we want to give someone a break, the fact the cops will be afraid to because it's on camera, that bothers me. You know, we've been down the last 3 years 30% in the arrests in the city, and I'm just afraid that's one drawback to it. I see all the positive benefits, but there was also a study done in Washington, D.C. that just came out, and they had, I believe, 1,000 cops wear the cameras, 1,000 didn't. Hmm. And at the end, they said there was no change in behavior whatsoever. So,
interesting.
So the results are across the board on this. We're going to wait to see how our results come out. And then obviously it's going to be up to the mayor and it's going to be up to the community. But I know from a police standpoint, it's been all positive.
Commissioner, we're really out of time. We've got maybe 30 seconds left. I want to just ask you one final question about 2018. What's the BPD's big issue, concern? What are you hoping for 2018?
Well, my biggest concern, it is every night before I go to bed is whatnot, is that all my officers are safe. And number two, that, you know, no one gets hurt in our city, especially by gunfire. That's how I like to measure my success. You know, crime has continued to go down in the city. Unfortunately, the senseless shootings are what we have to stop. And I hope 2018 is a peaceful and very safe year for all residents in our city and across this country.
Well, amen to that. Let's hope for a peaceful 2018. Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans, thank you for your work. Thanks for coming in for today. We're very grateful.
Yeah, and Merry Christmas. Happy holidays to everyone.
Merry Christmas and happy holiday to you as well. Stay with us. Coming up, Pat Purcell, president and publisher of Herald Media, joins us to discuss the sale of the Boston Herald. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Boston is one of the few cities left in America with two daily newspapers, the Boston Globe and the Boston Herald. But the big question now, will it remain a two-paper town? Just over a week ago, we learned that after a long effort to trim costs, freeze wages, and raise delivery prices, the longtime editor and publisher of the Herald, Pat Purcell, announced the company would enter bankruptcy and sell the paper. It was a difficult decision for Purcell, who's been at the helm of the Herald for almost 34 years. Today, we're happy to have him with us. And Pat Purcell, welcome to Radio Boston. It's good to have you.
Hi, Anthony.
Hello. And listen, I want to sort of say right off the bat that I'm sorry for what you're going through. I know this has been a tough time for you. The Herald has been probably a bit of a labor of love for you, so I'm imagining how difficult it must have been a week ago Friday to tell your employees at the Herald about this difficult decision. What was that like?
Extremely difficult. I mean, it's been difficult for everybody. You know, it's when you deliver bad news and people, no matter how you know, difficult it is, it's really difficult for the people who are really going to be impacted by this. And you know, you see what's going on in the industry. You look around and you see other papers that have gone through this, and it's an industry-wide issue. But we've dodged the bullet for so many times and in so many ways. We've always been able to kind of wiggle out of the straitjacket. But you know, we were just getting to the point where the primary objective that I have operated with for all these years has been to keep Boston a two-newspaper town and keep all of the great, talented people who work for the Herald try to continue to pride, you know, give them a livelihood.
I want to talk a little bit about that, but you mentioned two-newspaper town, and we all sort of take for granted that that's such an important idea. I know most folks who work in journalism embrace that. I'd love to hear a publisher's point of view on that. Why? Why is it important to have two-paper town?
It's the competition for ideas. It's the angle that you take on a story. It's the unique perspective that your columnists bring to your publication. You know, people have suggested to me, well, you know, why don't you become a broadsheet? Why do you have Howie Carr? Why do you have Joe Fitzgerald? Why do you have Peter Galzinis? You know, and the fact of the matter is that being a tabloid is a unique product distinction that makes us easier to read, and people like that. Having all of those columnists that I just mentioned means that we have a unique voice and a unique perspective, and articles and issues that aren't being tackled elsewhere, people can count on in the Herald, and they look forward to in the Herald. So those are unique product qualities that make us important to people. And, you know, Boston deserves that. You know, New York has it. Washington, D.C. has it. But so many other places had it, and now it's gone, and it's too bad. And the other news outlets, you know, aren't providing that.
Right. So I wonder if you could bring us up to date, Pat Purcell, about what we know about the possible sale of the Herald. I mean, when we first heard about this, we heard that Gatehouse Media was going to buy it. That's a newspaper chain which owns a bunch of dailies and weekly papers across Massachusetts. They're New York based. But since then, we understand there are three new possible buyers. Can you tell us what we know about that?
Well, there are some firms, some companies that we approached a lot of people early in the process. And all of them kind of passed on the opportunity. Gatehouse stepped forward, and I want to make sure I acknowledge the fact that we are very appreciative of the fact that they have stepped forward and that they want to try to keep the Herald's voice alive. Since the announcement and the bankruptcy filing, obviously the circumstances for a purchase change dramatically. So others are looking at it. There's nothing else to report other than the fact that they are looking at it.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the Herald having a viable future, do you see it as a good thing that there are potentially multiple suitors here?
Positively.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that other people are looking at it and have an idea of how they could run it, and I just hope that you know, that their idea and their financial wherewithal is sufficient to keep this voice alive and keep the folks employed.
Yeah. Let's say it's a company like Gatehouse Media. They own over 100 publications in Massachusetts, most of which are in Eastern Mass. It's also New York-based. I mean, do you think the paper changes if it shifts away from local ownership? Or what would be the impact of non-local ownership?
Bear in mind, Gatehouse really got its start when they acquired the community newspapers from me back in 2006.
Uh-huh.
You know, I had bought 90 weekly newspapers from Fidelity Investments back in 2001, and I wanted to have a bigger presence in the Boston market, be able to compete more effectively against the Globe with a broader base and a bigger economic base. And unfortunately, the time had come when the investors who helped me make that acquisition, they had a right to offer the company for sale. And so Gatehouse bought the community newspapers, and I retained the Boston Herald. They took that opportunity and built on it quite aggressively, and I think they've got probably 600-plus titles across the country now, and they really grew much more than I could. And I think that would be a good thing for the Herald. And if they can, and I think we haven't talked at all about what their plans were for the Herald, but I would think that they would appreciate all of the things that make the Herald unique and be able to leverage some of that uniqueness with some of the unique qualities of their own publications. Similar to what I was trying to do back in the early 2000s. So I think it can be a really good thing, particularly with the size of their balance sheet.
Well, that sounds like a hopeful view. Speak to an issue that some people are concerned about, and this idea that smaller papers around the country are being gobbled up by a few large companies. That can sound ominous if you sort of stated in a certain way, but is it ominous? Is there a concern or not?
You know, in this case, I think size is good. I think, you know, with the erosion of the advertising base, you know, the bigger the platform for online distribution of content, the bigger the platform that that advertisers could take advantage of. It's a good thing, and I think that anybody willing to enter this arena, because it is very competitive and it is challenging, anyone who wants to get into this arena should be applauded.
Hmm. I want to ask you, sort of taking the long view of what you've seen of the newspaper industry. I mean, obviously, we know it's a tough climate for newspapers right now. The rise of the internet, free online content, the demise of advertising and circulation revenue. As a longtime publisher who watched this from the ground up, you know, was there something different, with the benefit of hindsight, I'm asking, was there something different newspapers could have done years ago to better position themselves to weather this change?
I don't know the answer to that.
Mm. I know it's a tough question, but I thought if anyone could answer it, you could.
here's my perspective on that. When I was at News Corp back in the late, well, for a long time, and still maintain a very close association with News Corp, we saw the internet coming in its infancy, and we knew that classified advertising was extremely vulnerable, and that was going to change everybody. Some people got into the online distribution of content. I opted to go into the online business for classified and started JobFind back in, we launched probably in 96 or 97. And you remember Monster got its start around that, a little bit before that, here in New England. We knew classified was going to be vulnerable. We knew what nobody, and this is where I was going with the whole I don't know part of this answer. I don't know if anyone could have seen the impact of Google.
Interesting.
Google emerged in 1998. They launched. They had zero advertising revenue. By 2016, they are up to $70 billion.
Wow.
Newspapers have gone from $60 billion in 2000, around 2000, to $18 billion now. The ability of advertisers to target people based on what they click on has been unbelievable. And so, we need to preserve the voice of newspapers. We need to preserve the independent reporting of newspapers, the accuracy of reporting. With the age of the internet, people put out information much too quickly sometimes, and it turns out to be wrong. You know, the reporting principles of true reporting and accurate reporting must remain in place, but the economic base of these traditional legacy businesses are challenged.
Pat Purcell, I wanted to ask you about something your competitor wrote. The Boston Globe's publisher John Henry wrote an article thanking you for your years of service and dedication to Boston. How did that make you feel?
I was extremely flattered. We are a good customer of the Globe now because they do the printing of the Herald. They do the distribution of the Herald. I was flabbergasted that John was so complimentary, and I want to publicly thank him for that. And it really was something I was I'm very appreciative of. Mm. And I think that's what we've tried to do. I've tried to be a good steward. I've tried to be a good citizen. I've tried to be a good publisher, and tried my hardest to make sure that we provide people with important information, unique information, and provide an alternative for the advertisers in this community. And I feel very proud that we've been able to do that for so long. So it's been a little difficult recognizing that we're running out of runway.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. So after close to 34 years at the helm of this paper, what's next for you? I mean, assuming that this sale goes through, well, whether or not the sale goes through, what's next for you?
Well, I've been kind of practicing for retirement, even though I wasn't really retiring. But, you know, I've got a lot of outside interest, so I think I'm going to be just fine.
All right. Well, Pat Purcell, president and publisher of Herald Media Incorporated, thanks so much for joining us today, and I wish you all kinds of good luck. Thank you.
Anthony, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Duke Ellington's take on Tchaikovsky's famous Nutcracker Suite. The jazzy musical blend is at the heart of one of Boston's classic holiday dance shows, the Urban Nutcracker. Now in its 17th year, the Urban Nutcracker reimagines the traditional tale in downtown Boston beneath the glow of the Citgo sign with a modern jazz spin. The show was created by choreographer and local dance legend Tony Williams. His goal was to put a multicultural, diverse face on the traditional ballet. And Tony Williams joins us now in the studio to talk about the Urban Nutcracker. Welcome to Radio Boston. Great to meet you.
Thank you, Anthony. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, 17th season of the Urban Nutcracker. Did you think it would go this long when you started it?
I sure did not. Yeah. And I thought the first year that we did it, it probably wouldn't last more than a year, but I'm so happy that it has.
Yeah, it really has. So, you started this show in 2001, very different time. Talk a little bit about what you were thinking and hoping to create.
Sure. At that time, I had just started a dance school in Jamaica Plain, and I got lots of boys in my school, and they were attracted by my hip-hop teacher and my tap teacher. They were both men, young men, and they attracted about 20 boys. And so I had sort of a cast for a show, like a Nutcracker, and I said, oh, let's put on a show and let's do the Nutcracker. But hey, we can't really do the traditional Nutcracker because that's being done quite well already in Boston. And I had just heard Duke Ellington's suite for the Nutcracker, which is in orchestration for his big band based on Tchaikovsky's fantastic score. And because of my background as a ballet dancer, I said, I'll do the ballet and I'll have Ricardo Foster do hip-hop and Khalid Hill will do the tap. We have all these boys. We have girls. And because I had this dance school for the first time, I had a critical mass of the parents who, of course, help backstage.
Interesting. So now, tell me, say more about the Duke Ellington Suite. What drew you to this music?
Well, I've always loved jazz, and I had heard it on the radio, and I just was struck. I love Duke's. It's incredible. I love the music, and so I. That was the inspiration, and I at the time I was talking to some friends, and I'm saying I'm thinking of putting sort of intersecting Duke's music along with Tchaikovsky, and do you think it would work? And they said, oh yeah, try it. And so I got a sound engineer at the time, and we just sat down, and we just sort of first we'll start with some of the Ellington, and then we'll go to the classical Tchaikovsky, and some of it would lend itself to one of the dance styles because we had three or four dance styles that first year, and we still do now.
Well, let's hear a little bit about how you put this music together. You mentioned going from Ellington to Tchaikovsky. Here's a clip from Act Two where you go from Tchaikovsky to Ellington.
Okay.
Music from the Urban Nutcracker, and we're talking to Tony Williams. And this, Tony Williams, it's not just a reimagining of the music, it's also the story. So just to give listeners a little background here. So in the original Nutcracker ballet, we meet the entire Stahlbaum family, including the children Clara and Fritz. In the Urban Nutcracker, you've chosen to have the children's father away in the military, right?
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Why? Tell us about that change.
Well, when I first did the show in 2001, it was after 9/11. Actually, we did the show 3 months after that tragic event. And then, you know, then we went to war in Iraq the next year, I think, or in 2003. And so it was in 2003 that I adjusted the scenario to accommodate for the mother who has a daughter and a son, and it's Christmas Eve, and the father's not there. Where's the father? The father has been deployed. And so it just seemed to fit the times that we were in. And my show is it was sort of a realistic show that's sort of couched in this really lovely frame of entertainment and beautiful costumes and dancing. But yet it's not just a sort of a surfacey type show. There is that underlying realism that I wanted to bring. And that's, I think that's probably what I was thinking about at the time when I did that.
I want to ask you about the range of dancers that you use on stage, because there are professional dancers mixed with children on stage. I understand nearly 100 youth dancers age 5 to 18 in this show.
Yeah, that's true. Yes.
So what do you think dance teaches kids that's important, and what do they bring the show that's important?
First of all, the kids that we have are incredible, and I'm so happy that they are the future of the world, that these kids are so intelligent, and they have so much passion. They keep you really honest, the kids are they are the lifeblood of who doesn't like children? And yeah, but our kids are very well choreographed, well behaved. And what it does that I find I have kids that come from the projects, kids that come from wealthy backgrounds, and they're all working together, and they don't know that, oh, you might have a single mom and I live in a nice big house or something like that. There's a common denominator that is at work with these kids, and they have to work just as hard as the adults. It's like they have to learn their steps. They have to practice and do their homework, and I think it's just really great, you know, for self-confidence and also self-respect. That if they can feel good about themselves, they're going to feel good about the kid next to them that they work with, and kids at school and kids outside of the studio.
I think we should hear a little bit more music. So I want to play one more clip of your sort of the mashup of music. This is also from Act Two, where we're going from Tchaikovsky to, no, sorry, from Ellington this time to Tchaikovsky, the other way around. Here we go. That's the nutcracker that we've come to know all these decades later. So what is it about the Nutcracker story that makes it so popular year after year in all its iterations?
The music is just incredible. I think people just love it. It just carries one away. And with my show, we add these other dance styles. So we've had Turkish folk dance. We have flamenco, Irish step. We've had all sorts of dance types that we brought into the show through the years. But I think it's the music that does it, and it's an established tradition that we have in this country since the 50s. And And I danced the Nutcracker. I once danced in Oslo, hit the Opera House in Oslo, and we did a version of the Nutcracker there. But it was done after Christmas. It was in January. So it's not a Christmassy thing in Europe, but mm-hmm. in this country, it's around the time of Christmas. And I think with the whole festive holiday that, you know, was happening, I think that combination with Tchaikovsky makes it, it's just like you keep going back for more. It's great.
Well, Tony Williams is the creator and choreographer of the Urban Nutcracker, now in its 17th season in Boston. He's also founder and artistic director of the Tony Williams Dance Center. The Urban Nutcracker is on stage now at John Hancock Hall through December 28th. Tony Williams, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll go out on more Duke Ellington music from the show. This is from Ellington's album, The Nutcracker Suite. And that's it for today. Radio Boston's a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.